Black History Podcast. I'm your host, Nashad Carrington. This week we'll be starting the first of a two-part series on an emperor and head of state of a country on the African continent. So I want to give you just kind of a heads up of our outline and how we'll split the two episodes apart. This week's episode will actually focus on the man, his early life, his politics, his rise, his fall, and actually his eventual re-rise and untimely refall. And actually then next week we'll continue on with his legacy and what he's quite possibly most known for. And that episode will likely clear up a lot of the legacy misinformation that clouds him and the movement which he sparked. I won't call it his movement, and I'll tell you why next week, so just stay tuned and keep up. Haile Selassie was known by many names, not only in life, but also in death, many of which we will get to in the course of this episode, but obviously I'll try to start from the beginning, and that being when he was born. Through most of this episode, in order to prevent any confusion, though he does have many names, I will say the name, and it will be said then, but throughout the rest of the episode, I'll continue to refer to him strictly as Selassie. Also, throughout this episode, I do apologize in advance for any mispronunciations of ethnic names or cities, locations, tribe names that I may not be familiar with, but I will do my best to get the names correct. But, you know, most importantly, the mispronunciations, I do apologize. I just hope that I'm able to say it in a way that is understandable to you. So let's get right into it. Haile Selassie I was born Lij Tafiri Mekonnen, meaning a child that is to be respected or feared, on July 23, 1892, in Edrisa Goro of the Ethiopian Empire. He was given his Gaye's name, Haile Selassie, in his infant baptism, and then readopted the name again in 1930. As Selassie would eventually serve as emperor of Ethiopia, his royal bloodline was derived through his paternal grandmother, originating from the Amhara people, but also from lineages traced through the Amoro and Guraje people as well. His mother was the daughter of the Amoro ruler, Dejmak Ali Abba Jafar, while his father was the Ras Mekonnen, Wand Mikhel Gudessa, the governor of Harar. And his father served as a general in the First Italo-Ethiopian War, while also being close friends and cousins with the emperor. Through either folklore or legend, it is believed that Selassie is a direct descendant of King Solomon of Israel and the Queen of Sheba, who we most certainly will dedicate a future episode to. So just stay tuned for the Queen of Sheba episode coming. We already have it on our plan. We're working on it as we go. We'll really get more into this folklore and legend of this lineage between King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba in next week's episode, because that has a lot more to do with the legacy and the movement than this episode of, you know, the historical fact of his life. So just stay tuned next week and we'll discuss that a lot more. Selassie was actually raised as an Ethiopian Orthodox Christian and was taught very early in life by privately held European tutors. Much of his youth was actually spent in the court of the emperor in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. With an ever-changing political climate that was constantly filled with political plots and potential coups, Selassie learned a great deal about not only wielding political power, but also what it took to maintain that same power. The then emperor Menelik II recognized Selassie's intellectual abilities, capacity for hard work, his impressive memory, and his knack to master detail. And so when Selassie was only 14 years old, Menelik appointed Selassie the governor of Gara Muleta in the province of Harar. By the age of 20, Selassie was appointed to the equivalent of commander of a large province of Ethiopia called Sidamo. Emperor Menelik II had no male heir, and Selassie appeared to be a possible successor when his own father had passed away in 1906, and he was taken under the direct wing of Menelik. But in 1913, Menelik passed away, and it was actually his own grandson, Lij Yasu, that was appointed emperor. However, at the time of this transition, majority of Ethiopia's population practiced Christianity, but Yasu practiced and maintained a very close relationship with Islam, and was never really able to gain favor of the populace. Selassie quickly became the face of the opposition, and in 1916 stripped Yasuo of power and imprisoned him for life. In addition to the discord based on religion, it was relatively easy for Selassie to make the challenge for power. Yasuo had a strong reputation for very, very scandalous behavior throughout the empire, including being very dismissive and disrespectful to the other nobles, which damaged his reputation heavily. The ousting officially occurred on September 27, 1916. Now, we won't get into the heavy political details and the positioning that occurred after the overthrow, but let's suffice it in short order to say that the daughter of Menelik and Yasuo's aunt was named the Empress. Selassie was actually raised to the order of Ras, meaning the head, and was made the heir apparent and crown prince. It was at this time his name was changed to Ras Tafari. I'm quite sure you can already sense the inspiration for the naming of the movement which he would later inspire. However, for the time being, we will still refer to him as Selassie, but we'll get to his other names as they come. In the power shift that happened afterward, Selassie accepted the role of regent plenitarian and became the de facto ruler of the Ethiopian Empire, essentially meaning the empress would govern while Selassie would administer the empire. While Yasuo was deposed on September 27th, he was actually able to escape on October 8th into the Ogaden Desert, where he found his father, who was able to come to his support. On October 27th, Yasuo and his father, Niges Mikal, were defeated at the Battle of Sigael, and with that, any chance of Yasuo regaining the throne or any remaining semblance of power was gone, and he went into hiding. 5 years later, Yasuo is captured and taken into custody. Selassie had work to do in his time in becoming leader of the country, and the best way he saw fit was to gain a foothold with the younger population of Ethiopia, promising and seeking ways to modernize the country. Capturing what amounted to the hopes and dreams of this section of the populace, which comes with either great or terrible results. Interestingly enough, I feel like this political ascent parallels that to the charismatic leader which we saw in the United States that rose to prominence representing the hopes and dreams of the young masses, President Barack Obama. The rise wasn't exactly the same, but the overthrow of the old unpopular guard that had lost touch with the representative thought, Yasuo's being that of religion and Bush and the Republican parties being that of standing in the economic and geopolitical arena, with a person promising to lead the country forward in a new way that is best effective for the younger masses. In 1923, Selassie led Ethiopia into the League of Nations, and for you history buffs, the predecessor to the United Nations, on the back and strength of his promise to eradicate slavery, and the following year became the first leader of Ethiopia to travel abroad when he went to Europe. In 1926, Selassie took control of the army, a political and social action that now made him strong enough to assume and name himself officially with the title of Niges, meaning king. I want to take a second here just to pause and have a slight little aside with maybe even some, I'll say, poetic interlude as well. One of the things that people know who know me know is that I love good hip-hop, good conscious hip-hop, good intelligent hip-hop, because it is poetry in motion. Very recently, we actually had a great young hip-hop artist by the name of Kendrick Lamar reference this term Niges in a song called I that's on his album To Pimp a Butterfly. I want to play a little clip of that and the poetry that he puts into it and the definition as well. So just pause for me for a quick second. Go grab a drink while you listen to it, because it's literally Kendrick Lamar spitting poetry.
No better than Samuel on the Django. No better than a white man with slave boats. Sound like I needed some soul searching. My pops gave me some game in real person. Retraced my steps on what they never taught me. Did my homework fast before government caught me. So I'ma dedicate this one verse to Oprah on how the infamous sensitive N-word controllers. So many artists gave her an explanation to hold us. Well, this is my explanation, straight from Ethiopia. N-E-G-U-S, definition, royalty. King royalty. Wait, listen. N-E-G-U-S. Description, black emperor, king ruler. Now let me finish. The history books overlooked the word and hide it. America tried to make it to a house divided. The homies don't recognize we've been using it wrong. So I'ma break it down and put my game in a song. N-E-G-U-S, say it with me, or say no more. Black stars can come and get me. Take it from Oprah Winfrey, tell her she right on time. Kendrick Lamar, by far, realest sneakers alive.
If you notice right there, he actually refers to Ethiopia being the source of this term, Negus. But let's jump back to the Selassie. I encourage you in the interim to listen to Pimp a Butterfly. It is a great album from beginning to end. Kendrick Lamar truly is one of the poetry spokespersons of our time and the spokesman from the streets of Compton. But not only that, but the struggle of the current day African-American in this country. But I apologize again for the aside. Let's jump back to Selassie. In 1930, the Empress died, leaving Selassie as the sole leader of the country. And as such, Selassie then demanded the title Negasa Negast, translating to King of Kings, and took control fully and officially, assuming the name Haile Selassie I, translating to Power of the Trinity. Selassie's coronation was a lavish affair that was attended by royals and heads of state all around the world, including Egypt, the United States, Turkey, Sweden, Belgium, and Japan. The New York Times reported the expensive gifts received by the attendees and speculated that the celebrations may have even cost more than $3 million. While the New York Times reported on the celebrations, Selassie graced the cover of Time magazine as well, on November 3rd, 1930. We'll touch to what gave him the cover in just a moment, because even though his coronation was huge, he made the cover for something much more noble and fitting for the legacy that he was left. One of Selassie's actual first actions was to draft a new constitution for the country and assembling the first parliament in November of 1931. These actions were designed to give control of the country to the nobility based on heredity rather than on democracy. And while the Constitution limited the power of the regional princes, there was only one challenging person to the new Constitution. However, this dissent was set aside as this member of parliament was jailed for life in 1932 under the guise of not only challenging the Constitution, but also for attempting to help Yasu escape from prison. While continuing to move the burgeoning country forward on the international stage, Selassie was actually forced into exile in 1936 after Ethiopia was invaded by Italy. The fascist regime of Benito Mussolini was eager to avenge the military defeats that Ethiopia had dealt to Italy in the First Italo-Abyssinian War in 1896. Now, right here, we're not going to go into the depths regarding the political history of the Ethiopia and Italian conflicts, but let's just suffice for our purposes to say that Italy was essentially trying to reestablish the land bridge that it had previously held uniting its colonies in present-day Eritrea and Somalia, and Ethiopia would have accomplished that. One would think that Ethiopia's place as a recognized member of the League of Nations would protect or insulate it from attack or invasion. However, this is actually one of the events that proved just how wholly ineffective the notion of collective security was from the League of Nations. Furthermore, it was also later revealed in the Hor Laval Pact that the countries that were supposed to be Ethiopia's allies in the League of Nations were actually working against its interest in an effort to make Italy happy. The pact went as far as to offer to partition Ethiopia and provide Mussolini with a portion of the country as an Italian colony, and the countries that were involved actually were Britain and France. And compared to the Ethiopians, the Italians had an advanced and modern military, which also included a very large air force. The Italians would also employ the use of chemical weapons throughout the conflict and even targeted field hospitals of their Red Cross, both of these being in violation of the Geneva Convention, but was very likely done with the knowledge of the international community. While the battle started slowly, Selassie joined the Ethiopian army on the northern front and launched a counterattack against the Italians. But it became apparent that the country's capital of Addis Ababa would not be able to defend and the government should relocate to the southern town of Gor. In the movement, it was determined that Selassie's wife and the rest of the family should actually relocate in exile first to the country of Djibouti and then continue on to Jerusalem. There was great debate as to whether Selassie should join the family in exile. However, it was ultimately determined that he should and present the case of Ethiopia to the League of Nations. Because the League of Nations provided Selassie an audience for his address, Italy withdrew its delegation in May of 1936. After being introduced as quote, His Imperial Majesty, the Emperor of Ethiopia, a number of Italian journalists in attendance began to jeer and heckle the emperor. It was at this point that Selassie, in pure regal fashion, calmly waited until the crowd had calmed, and then delivered what has been considered one of the most stirring speeches of the 20th century. While perfectly capable and fluent in French, Selassie decided instead to give his speech in his native language of Amharic. In this speech, Selassie veiledly charged that the League of Nations was not holding up its end of the bargain in collectively protecting its member states, as he pointed out that the same European states that it found in favor of Ethiopia joining the League of Nations were actually the same European countries that were now denying Ethiopia credit and materials, while also providing the same needed aid to Italy, which was using weapons and material to destroy Ethiopia's military and civilian targets. It was this speech that actually made Selassie an icon for anti-fascists across the world, and this occasion that Time magazine named him Man of the Year. However, in an act that showed its inherent ineffectiveness, as well as European loyalties, Selassie was unable to get what was needed most from the League of Nations. The League would only agree to partial sanctions that would ultimately prove ineffective against Italy. The speech was impassioned, but as mentioned, was ineffective to stop both the occupation of Ethiopia and ultimately the exile that Selassie and his family found themselves in. Selassie would be in exile from 1936 to 1941 and spent much of this time in Bath, England, where he bought a house after being given political asylum by the British, which is actually quite interesting considering the fact that the British were implicit in the Italian occupation of his home country. But during this time, he actually penned a 90,000-word essay and story of his life. While Selassie was accustomed to a life of luxury in Ethiopia, including a life surrounded with an army of servants, in Bath, the imperial family had to adjust to a completely new lifestyle of living. In Bath, rather than the palace, the family actually lived in a single house with very strong financial restrictions. And at one point, Selassie was reduced to pawning jewelry on a couple of occasions to lessen these financial restraints. His time in exile certainly was not wasted. To say otherwise would surely taint his legacy. And during this time, outside of his life story, his energies were centered around countering Italian propaganda as to the state of Ethiopian resistance and the legality of the occupation. Selassie was completely unafraid to speak out against the Italian occupation, desecrating religious structures and historical artifacts, including a 1600-year-old imperial obelisk. And he condemned the suffering and atrocities that the Ethiopian people were suffering at the hands of the Italian military. Selassie continued his impassioned pleas to the League of Nations as well, essentially begging for the League to exhibit some strength in protecting the militarily weaker countries that were supposed to be under its fold, espousing that, quote, God's judgment will eventually visit the weak and the mighty alike, end quote. However, in true Eurocentric fashion, Selassie's attempts to gain support for the struggle against Italy was mainly unsuccessful. That is, until Italy entered World War II on the German side in June of 1940. When Italy declared war against England, the British flew Selassie to Sudan and helped him build an army. Essentially, the British military might, coupled with Selassie's populist appeal, joined efforts into a concerted effort to liberate the country. Now, right here, it's interesting to note at this point that the British interest in making this military effort on the Ethiopian front, as noted before, not only did the British first have a stake in Ethiopia being brought into the League of Nations, but then entered into a pact with France, essentially allowing Italy full rights to invade the autonomous country, and actively ignoring the police to give assistance to Ethiopia and removing the assistance from Italy. And then, once Italy declared themselves the enemies of England, England then had the purpose and cause to finally enter the African continent for the right reasons. On January 18, 1941, Selassie and his forces crossed the border between Sudan and Ethiopia. And ultimately, Italy was defeated by a coalition of forces from England, Free France, Free Belgium, and the Ethiopian Patriots. And on May 5th, 1941, Selassie entered the capital city of Addis Ababa, 5 years to the day since his exile in 1936. His welcoming address stated in part, quote, "Today is the day on which we defeated our enemy. Therefore, when we say let us rejoice with our hearts, let not our rejoicing be in any other way but in the spirit of Christ. Do not return evil for evil. Do not indulge in the atrocities which the enemy has been practicing in his usual way, even to the last. Take care not to spoil the good name of Ethiopia by acts which are worthy of the enemy. We shall see that our enemies are disarmed and sent out the same way they came. As Saint George, who killed the dragon, is the patron saint of our army, as well as our allies, let us unite with our allies in everlasting friendship and amity, in order to be able to stand against the godless and cruel dragon, which has newly risen and which is oppressing mankind," end quote. Following the issue with Italy in exile during World War II, Selassie came back into Ethiopia triumphant and ready to continue moving the country forward into the new era. His method of progressive politics continued to make Ethiopia recognized on the world stage, and especially on the African continent. In August 1942, Selassie passed a resolution to abolish slavery and impose severe penalties for those engaging in the slave trade, up to and including death. Taking the high road, and possibly as a method of political condescension as well, in 1947, when England was suffering from some heavy flooding, Selassie sent aid to the British government, penned with the note, "Even though we are busy helping our own people, who didn't recover from the crisis of the war, we heard that your fertile and beautiful country is devastated by the unusually heavy rain and your request for aid. Therefore, we are sending small amounts of money, about £1,000, through our embassy to show our sympathy and cooperation." I say a bit of political condescension because in 1947, £1,000 only carried a present-day value of about £27,000, or about $42,000. Obviously not enough to make much of a dent in the issues facing the British government. After World War II, Ethiopia became a charter member of the United Nations. This membership came with its privileges to Ethiopia as well, and in 1948, a disputed piece of Somalia land was actually granted to Ethiopia. And in 1950, the UN General Assembly established a former Italian colony into Ethiopia. This land was to have its own constitution, providing for ethnic, linguistic, and cultural appropriation, but Ethiopia was to control and manage this region's finances, defense, and foreign policy. The region discussed is present-day Eritrea. Selassie wasn't able to accomplish all of his political aims, however. And in 1942, he tried to push for a progressive tax, which was opposed strongly by the nobility, and so instead he was forced to just settle on a flat tax, which in 1951, the nobility succeeded in having reduced again. In November of 1955, Selassie was in the midst of celebrating his Silver Jubilee, a celebration marking 25 years of reign, when he announced a revised constitution. While he would still retain power, he did take a step further and extend the political participation to the people as well by the creation of a lower house of parliament that was to be an elected body. Political parties were not created in the sense that we think of them as Democrat and Republican, as political parties were not addressed in this constitutional revision. Again, this move was very bold on the part of Selassie from before he came to power, there being a very strong monarch government with the emperor wielding all power, to him providing for a house of parliament and then expanding that even further to provide representation to the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, as well as was huge to galvanize the support and remain a respected member of the populist government. Now, in December of 1960, Selassie's reign was challenged, with his Imperial Guard force staging a coup d'etat while he was on a state visit to Brazil, with the Guard then instilling his oldest son, the Crown Prince Asfawusin. However, the coup was very short-lived, actually only lasting a total of 4 days, and by the 17th of the month, Selassie loyalists had actually crushed the coup and had regained control of the capital city, with the conspirators either dead or fleeing the city. And in about a period of 35 years of rule, the coup attempt was considered to be the toughest and most serious threat to Selassie's reign until the activities of 1974, which we'll address pretty soon. So just hang on right there. So the coup actually marked a staunch change in the populist support that Selassie enjoyed in the country. Now, if you remember, earlier we mentioned that Selassie came to power on the back and with the heavy support of the youth and the lower classes of the populace. Well, the coup was actually heavily supported by students and the educated classes. In fact, during the four-day revolt, the launching event and rally was held at Haile Selassie University. However, the revolt did have a bit of positivity for Ethiopia. And in fact, the coup actually spurred Selassie to accelerate reform that was actually seen through land grants, primarily to the military and to police officials. But in fact, the coup actually marked a turning point in Ethiopian history as well. It was the first time that Ethiopians had questioned the power of the king to rule without the people's consent. The students' population began to empathize with the peasant class and the poor, and actually stood to fight and advocate on their behalf. And in 1961, tension spilled over in the colonization of Eritrea as the Eritrean War of Independence began. Selassie declared that Eritrea was the 14th province of Ethiopia. This obviously didn't sit well with the Eritreans. This conflict would continue for an additional 30 years, and through the remainder of Selassie's reign and into the next. Each would try to retain Eritrea province by force. In 1963, Selassie presided over the Organization of African Union, what was the precursor to the present-day African Union. In fact, the headquarters was actually set in Addis Ababa. With the help of Mali's then-president Modibo Keita, Selassie was able to negotiate the Bamako Accords, which would actually bring about the end to the border dispute between Algeria and Morocco. And then in 1964, Selassie would initiate and champion the concept of the United States of Africa, a proposition that was eventually later taken up by Muammar Gaddafi. In 1966, Selassie again attempted to create a progressive tax, which would include the registration of land, similar to our deed of records here in the United States, which would have severely weakened the economic stranglehold of nobility in Ethiopia. This tax would actually lead to a major revolt, which, while being suppressed, actually began to signal the beginning of the end. The revolt achieved its aims of undermining the tax, but also set in the works the process by which landowners were not afraid to defy and violently express their disdain for certain policies. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, unrest amongst the student populace in Ethiopia was at an all-time high. Marxism had actually taken its roots in large swaths of the Ethiopian intelligentsia, primarily amongst those who had studied abroad and had been exposed to outside influences, primarily radical and left-wing sentiments becoming popular in other parts of the globe. A lot of the conflict and backlash that Selassie began to feel, resulting in him turning over a good bit of domestic governance and control to his prime minister, Akilu Hapti Wode, while he concentrated on foreign affairs. Outside of Ethiopia, Selassie was revered and continued to enjoy prestige and respect, as he was then the longest-standing head of state in power as he traveled to global events, including the funeral for John F. Kennedy and the Frenchman Charles de Gaulle. He was often given precedence over other leaders in attendance. In 1971, Selassie visited China as the first head of state to meet Mao Zedong following the death of Mao's successor, Lin Biao. However, the reception around this time was not the same as at home. Human rights were at an all-time low. Civil and political rights were at the same levels as well. Imprisonment and torture of political prisoners, as well as exceptionally low prison conditions, were rampant throughout the country. Even more, the military was exceptionally vicious to separatists, including a policy to destroy Eritrean villages that supported the rebels. There were a number of mass killings of hundreds of civilians during the war in the late 60s and early 70s. Between 1972 and 1974, a famine actually struck northeastern Ethiopia, and a BBC News report would estimate that over 200,000 people would die. But other estimates put the numbers closer to 40 to 80,000, which either is a number that is too high for the comfort of the populace, especially those who are already at their wits' end with Selassie and his rule. Dissidents use the higher figures to backdrop the famine against the images of Selassie presiding at grand wedding feasts on the grounds of his palace. Definitely not the image the country needed to see. There are some reports that say Selassie was unaware of the actual extent of the famine, while others state that he was well aware of it. So essentially, the jury's still out on that, whether Selassie knew and what he didn't know exactly, but there are also reports that corrupt local officials were also keeping information from the imperial government. Now, the famine was made much, much worse by military mutinies and high oil prices that came as a result of the 1973 oil crisis. Now, the international economic crisis caused the cost of imports, gasoline, and food to skyrocket while unemployment reached record levels. And in February of 1974, serious riots in the capital city resulted in 5 people dead. Selassie then responded by announcing on national television a government-sponsored reduction in gas prices and a freeze on the price of basic commodities. These promises had the effect of calming the public, but when the 30% pay increase to the military never materialized, the army mutinied. The then prime minister resigned, and the newly appointed prime minister granted a number of concessions, but they weren't enough to stop the impending 4-day general strike that brought the nation to a standstill. A group of low-ranking military officials set up a committee known as the DERG to investigate the military's demands and ultimately took advantage of the government's confusion to depose Selassie on September 12, 1974. Selassie was placed under house arrest, and most of his family was detained at a residence north of the capital. And by mid-November, about 60 former high officials of the imperial government were executed without trial, which included Selassie's grandson and 2 former prime ministers. To Ethiopians, even to present day, this day is known as Bloody Saturday. Now, we'll move a bit to a sadder part of the Selassie legacy, but likely the most pressing to what solidified the legacy that he's remembered for in current pop culture and Rastafari lore. We say lore not intended to be disrespectful to any religion or belief of people or movement, but the legacy Selassie is famous for is that one of legend and lore to a large degree. There's been some confusion as to what actually happened to Selassie. He wasn't finally put to an official burial place until 25 years after his death. And another piece of the story that actually clouds the true knowledge of the death is that the reports were delivered through official state media. And while that may not seem strange as he was a former head of state, this is the same state that had deposed him only 1 year prior. Now, on August 28th of 1975, it was actually reported that the quote ex-monarch, Haile Selassie, had died the day before of respiratory failure, following complications from a prostate exam. It would be years later in 1996 that Selassie's personal doctor, Asrat Woldevis, would publicly claim that Selassie had not died of public natural causes. As you can imagine, these conflicting reports leave a good bit of speculation as to the true cause of his demise, with many loyalists to this day being convinced that Selassie was instead assassinated. Now, the theories and speculation are able to survive because the atmosphere of suspicion and distrust were at an all-time high at that time in not only Ethiopia, but especially in the capital city of Addis Ababa. The Derg would officially collapse in 1991, and in 1992, Selassie's bones were found under a concrete slab on the palace grounds. Some reports have said that his bones were in fact found on the floor of a palace bathroom, just adding additional disrespect to the desecration. And after some years of debate and dispute regarding the remains and where the body should be placed, in November of 2000, Selassie was finally able to receive a proper burial in Addis Ababa's Trinity Cathedral. This is probably a great place for us to end part one of this episode, as part two will focus on the impact of Selassie to the Rastafari movement. In closing, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Please be sure to check us out each week for new and updated topics, especially next week for part two, Selassie and Modern Rastafarianism. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, please feel free to visit our website at www.theblackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com and navigate to the podcast tab at the top. As we develop and grow, you will find an archive of each episode, plans for future episodes, as well as additional links to books and resources that will help you in the journey to self-enlightenment. We encourage you to share our episodes with your friends, your family, your children, your grandchildren, your cousins, your aunts, uncles, and the girl from around the corner who you used to know, and everyone else. We encourage you to send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspective to an episode we've done, we will make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes. Please, as we take this journey together, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some additional commentary presented. But if you come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Thank you again, and we look forward to part two.